Welcome, listeners, to another episode of the Closer's Inner Circle podcast, hosted by your partner in Success Radio. I am your host, Denise Griffiths, and together with my co-host, Bengay III, we're diving into the world of sales mastery with the Gym from the Closer's Part 2. You've heard me say this before. These books, Parts 1 and 2, are widely known across the world, not just here in America. They're known as the Sales Bibles. And today we are dealing with unexpected customer objections and delays from the Closer's Part 2. And listen, there are times when no matter what you do, no matter how careful you've been, your customers will still pop up with some unexpected objection or delay. And if you are not yet familiar with the Closer's Part 2 by Bengay, the book delves into the nuanced, sophisticated techniques and mindset strategies used by the top master closers in the sales profession. They're famous. Millions of copies have been sold. If you don't have yours, Ben will tell you how to find them when we close up here. But the Closers Part 1 and 2, again, are widely known and recognized as the Sales Bibles. So this week, we are opening the book up to this chapter. It's called And Another Thing, and I keep saying that. This is, I think, our eighth week, and we are journeying to page 244. I'm going to apologize. I lost one of my cats last night, and it was a long night. It's been a long morning, so I'm a little bit rattled, so please just bear with me. And we're talking specifically to the segment titled, Is It Really Real? So last week, we covered curing the Be Back Blues, and I invite you to revisit our previous conversations and all seven of them to follow along as we delve into the narrative. And Ben says, and he said it to me last week, and I read it again in the book, he says that this chapter, in his opinion, is worth the price of the whole book. And he should know since he wrote it. Ben, good morning. It's Wednesday.
Good morning. How are you? Well, I shouldn't say that because I know you're physically worn out and mentally down in the dumps. I'm very sorry about the loss of your 19-year-old cat. That's a pretty good run.
Yeah, she's such a sweetheart. But I knew yesterday when she fell over after eating that was the end. It was just a very long day and a very long night. I slept a whole 2 hours, so I'm in good shape. So we're here, though, and I'm glad we are, because I need something to get my mind off of wanting to, you know, burst into tears every 10 minutes.
I'm very, very sorry. On a lighter note, you just talked about the Closers series around the world and so on. You reminded me of something I haven't thought of in years. When we sold the rights to the Closers in India, somehow in conversation, I heard the guy say, now you understand that means 26 languages. And I said, no, you're just getting the rights to India.
You didn't know your geography, did you?
Yeah. 20 in India, and this may not be right now, but on the day he bought the rights to it, we sold the rights to the Closers in 26 dialects and languages in India. He doesn't have the rights to anything outside of the borders of India and 26 dialects. He said, I'll send you samples. I said, I can barely read English. Send me checks.
Yeah, those I can read. Numbers I understand.
Yeah. With lots of zeros on the end. And I think we're in 15 real languages, you know, German, French, Spanish, whatever, around the world. But I was really impressed. Called my mother, I think, or called somebody and said, Mom, we're in 26, I'm now in 26 languages and dialects. And she says, wow, all over the world? I said, no, India.
India, yeah. That's a huge continent.
Yeah. So. Well, it was impressive. Anyway, yeah. I got a couple of emails this morning I thought I'd hit on, since we're always encouraging people to ask questions.
Yeah, go for it.
And so I wanted to reward them with some reaction to that. I got one about the Les Davis letter thing. You and I covered that several programs ago. I'll recap it quickly. But what he wanted to know was what happened. He missed the point. Les Davis was a top salesman. By the time I knew him, he was vice president of Nightingale Conant. That's how I met him. But before that, he was with SMI, Success Motivation Institute in Waco, Texas, Paul Myers' old company. And he was their top guy. And he had a massive heart attack, almost died, and was out for, I don't know, 6 months, a year, whatever. He was out long enough where he lost his pacing, his momentum. And when he returned, the energy wasn't back yet. So he thought maybe that was it. But he no longer was their top salesman, to say the least. Paul said, if I didn't know you and love you, I'd have fired you. Because he just couldn't hit it. So his wife, Lil, said to him one day, why don't you do what you taught everybody else to do all those years? And she was reminding him of, you know, it's often easier to teach than to do. And she reminded him of several things he used to preach and do himself and so on. Among them was sending an assumptive letter to people that he was going to call on in a week or two or whatever, and saying, I'm going to be in your town, you know, in your business park, whatever, on Wednesday, the whatever, and I'd like to drop in and see you. So unless I hear otherwise from you, I will meet you at 10 o'clock in the morning in your office, etc. I'm paraphrasing. I'm not sure I ever saw the actual letter. And he waited the 2 or 3 days, because they were all pretty much local people he was writing to in and around the Dallas area. And he started going out and making, it was like the old days. He walked in, announced his arrival, and presented the material Success Motivation Institute was selling at the time. It was on records. This is before cassettes, but motivational recordings and sales training and so on. And he was back to doing well. And a couple of, and to the point, they sent a few more letters out, but basically he didn't need that anymore. Referrals were carrying him once again. So, couple, 3 years later, whatever, go by, and they decide to sell their old Cadillac convertible, and they're cleaning it out to make sure they're not losing anything or leaving significant money under the cushions or whatever. And they lift out the back seat, and there was every letter in the first batch, like 50 letters. 2 or 3 years old now, hadn't gone anywhere. It turned out they'd given the letters to their son to take to the post office and mail. And like a typical teenager, I guess he was old enough to drive, he threw them in the back seat. When he got wherever he went next, they weren't there because they'd slipped down in the cushion. And he never gave it another thought. I assume if he'd seen the letters, he probably would have done something with them. But the letters were under the seat, never mailed, and yet Les's career was back on track, and he was now senior vice president or whatever of sales at SMI. And so we told the story, and I thought the point was sort of obvious. The letter, the mailing of the letters had given him his confidence back. He knew they were expecting him. These were now warm leads instead of cold leads. And it gave him the confidence to walk in, like my friend Ray Considine, you have his book, and, you know, go, Considine, you know, and they let him in places. Les was walking in and saying, hi, Les Davis, I have a 10 o'clock appointment with so-and-so, because he had not called back to cancel the appointment. He's thinking the reason he hadn't called back was he never got the letter. So the point was to my friend, our friend who was questioning it, confidence in selling is a huge step. And although it was through letters that didn't get mailed, Les Davis got his confidence back. And it was 2, 3 years later, after he'd regained his footing, after he was vice president of sales with SMI, that he discovered that he'd only tricked himself. The people didn't know. Oh, and he told me stories of some people say, well, you know, he's not here today. Well, that's odd. Well, we'll make it up to you, Mr. Davis. I will put you down, and they make an appointment for the next day or 2 days from now or what have you. But his being let in rate was fantastic. And so that was the point of that particular story. Motivation through confidence.
Right. Go ahead. And you use the word assumptive, and I think that's really the word that we all need to pay attention to. Mm-hmm. He assumed that those letters had hit their target, that nobody was saying, no, 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 don't come here. He was able to say, oh, this is great. You know, nobody's telling me to, no, the door is closed to you. So it was assumptive.
Absolutely. And he taught assumptive selling. J. Douglas Edwards coined that term. It's in the book, Sales Closing Power, that I wrote for Doug after he died. But it was his idea originally. I'm really in the book just quoting him. But there's probably the best example of assumptive selling I've ever seen. In that case, it was assumptive appointment setting. Once he got in, he still had to sell him on buying the records and training programs or whatever. But the important part was get in the door. If Les could get in the door and look in the eye, he had a very high closing ratio because he was an excellent salesperson. But he wasn't an excellent salesperson when the confidence went away.
Right.
And there's nothing better. I always brag about my closing rate. It's 86%. It varies, I'm sure, but basically they check it periodically. It's 86% on significant sales, not taking a book order over the phone. But while I get patted on the back for that, I always remember that when I started the call center, the 800 call center industry with the National Communication Center, the closing ratio on the floor among 150 operators, roughly, telephone representatives, was right at 100%. And they're talking to strangers, and they're talking about products they hardly know anything about, because before computers were everywhere, what they had in front of them was, it looked like a Sears catalog on a stand. And when you asked for operator 1510, my telephone rep turned to page 1510 and read what it said. This is operator 1510, and I've been asked to take your blah, 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 and read the script that had been written for that client for those incoming calls. Their closing rate was right at 100%. Brand new telephone reps.
Right, those were warm calls
incoming. They didn't call because they were lonely. They called to buy something. And so obviously their closing rate would be higher. I used to marvel to see what they were saying. And one of them said to me one day, Mr. Gay, what we're saying is we're reading the scripts you wrote for all of these people. And then she said, and they're remarkably similar, which they were. This is operator 1510 for Xerox High. This is operator 1542 for Elvis Presley Records. And then I've been asked to take your name, your debt, and it was assumptive. I'm not going to ask you what you want. Let's first get the paperwork out of the way. Name, address, mailing address, credit card number, et cetera. And again, assumptive selling. So we sort of put that experience that Les Davis had with his idiot son, as he used to call him, his experience that he had with the idiot son, made it an assumptive sale. So I've told you the story before. In the early days, when I was a manufacturer's rep traveling on the road in the southeastern United States, I was early 20s, and scared to death and had no confidence, had no training other than the basic Macy's training. Will that be cash or credit card? Which was pretty much the sales training that we had. So what I did most mornings, we had contracts with F.W. Woolworth, the five and dime thing, Kresge's, all the forerunner to Kmart, all of those type companies, for a product called Contact stick-on shelf paper. I assume they still sell it. I see it in various people's cabinets when we're visiting their home. It wasn't like they had to buy, but they were happy I came by because they didn't have to count the rack to see what they were out of or check the back room. So I would walk in, wave if I saw anybody, whether I did or not, and then walk into the, check the rack, go in the back room, see what they had, what they needed, wrote up the order and handed it to the manager, tracked down the manager. And I said, "Hi, I'm Ben Gay with Conhall Marks. And here's what you need in the way of contact stick-on paper today." And he'd go, "All right, great. Sign it and hand it to me." The reason, I was supposed to do that sometime during the day, but the reason I did it first thing in the morning frequently was so when I made my second call of the day to someone who's a little more iffy, they didn't have to buy 50 lawnmowers from me if they didn't want to. They were independent buyers. When I called on him or her, I already had a signed order in my pocket for that day. Earlier that day, before I saw you, and I might even refer to it. I said, "I hope I'm not late. I was running a little bit late. Took a big order over at whatever, fill in the blank, HL Green, Kresge's, whatever." And I want them to know I'm a successful salespeople. You're not a salesperson. You're not the only human on earth I sell to. This isn't my first rodeo. And I could feel the order. If I moved in certain ways, I could feel the order crinkling in my pocket. And it was like Les Davis. It gave me confidence.
Right.
So, and I could feel the difference if I didn't do that some mornings and I went out, especially in the early days before my confidence level rose. I could feel the difference if I hadn't made a sale. But as soon as I got one in my pocket, I was a different person. And that assumptiveness was a big part of that. The second question we got was, and I don't remember discussing this, you and me on this show, but somewhere he heard about Billy Graham's Modesto Manifesto. And he said, "Would you explain that?" Does that sound familiar to you, Denise?
It does a little bit. We had talked about Billy Graham, but I don't recall the manifesto.
Okay.
So keep on going.
Well, early in Billy Graham's career, the Billy Graham Evangelistic Association, they had a couple of near brushes. I wouldn't say with scandal, but with misunderstandings and about their ministry. One of them was caused, and I remember the picture. I was a young boy in Atlanta, and I must have picked up the paper to bring it in. But there was a picture on the front page of the Atlanta Constitution, which used to be the morning paper in Atlanta, of Billy Graham coming out of a revival with a bag of cash in his hand, a burlap bag, cash bag like banks used to use, holding it up with an awkward smile on his face like he just robbed a bank. And the picture went on and the story went on to talk about they'd had a successful revival series in Atlanta. And that was pretty much it. But the picture was unfortunate because, as I said, it looked like he just robbed a bank. It made him look greedy, et cetera. And apparently they'd had another couple of brushes with things like that. So George Beverly Shea, I think was his name, and Billy Graham, and the other two whose names aren't coming to me, they were four that formed the Billy Graham Evangelistic Association before they decided he was the leader. It wasn't all that set in the beginning. Any one of them could have done it. Cliff Barrows was another member of the group. One decided it was Billy was the showman. Let's put him out front. And then a couple of brushes with scandal. And then they were in Modesto, California. And they took 4 days, the four of them. And they wrote up, marked up, redid it, had it typed up and so on, the Modesto Manifesto. And they laid down, and you can Google, listeners, Google the Modesto Manifesto, and you can read it. but it was the constitution, so to speak, of the Billy Graham Evangelistic Association, what they would do, wouldn't do. Some in there is an example of they would never, no one of them ever would be alone in a room with a woman. Because
well, that makes sense, especially now.
Yeah, in that business, it does. Because many, I call it the power of the microphone. I'm a much more handsome, attractive person after I've given a seminar to a group big enough to need a microphone. I call it the power of the microphone. People who wouldn't say hello to me in the lobby are flocking to get my autograph and so on after the talk or after the seminar or what have you. And a young evangelist could easily fall victim to young ladies clamoring for his attention and wanting his autograph, and one thing leads to another and so on. So that's in the Modesto Manifesto. No one of them ever again would be alone in a room. Didn't mean bedroom, any room. As soon as they saw they were alone with a woman, they would exit the room, go to the dining room, go to the whatever, so that no one could ever take a picture. Today they would really have a fit with all the cell phone cameras around, but back then, take a picture, start a rumor or what have you. So they wrote up their code of contact, of conduct, excuse me, in the Modesto Manifesto. And I would suggest that I have one that I wrote. I call it the Modesto Manifesto, although it has nothing to do with Billy Graham or religion or anything. It has to do with how I conduct myself and what I say and don't say and how I back things up or don't say them to start with, so I won't have to back them up. Read the Modesto Manifesto, understand why they wrote it, and understand that you, if you're a salesperson or a business owner, but I'll lump you all as salespeople, you as salespeople, especially salespeople in general, and especially used car salespeople, have an approval and trust rating lower than the media, lower than Congress. I saw
these days, I don't know. I don't trust any of those folks.
Yeah.
I'll take a used car salesman before I'll let any one of those people cross my door.
Well, the there are many fine ones, but they deal with that reputation.
I know.
And so many other people have soiled the pond long before they came along. So that's what you're, you know, it's, hi, I'm Ben Gay. I'm a salesperson. That means I'm a liar, cheat, and thief and can't be trusted. Now, we've acknowledged that problem. Let me explain to you why I'm really the exception to the, we have 18 million members of the National Association of Professional Salespeople, and most of them are fine, wonderful people, but all of us carry that reputation with us and we have to get around it. But it becomes easier when you have your personal Modesto Manifesto. So if whoever asked that question or asked for clarification, that's the reason I would have been talking about it. Billy Graham equal used car salesman. If you don't do anything to correct it or you do anything to enhance that negative reputation, and they decided not to. And as a result, some people like revivals and some people don't, and some people like ministers and some people don't. But since that awkward picture in Atlanta in 1948, there hasn't been a breath of scandal about the Billy Graham Evangelistic Association. And now his son Franklin is running it. And in addition to that, Franklin started Samaritan's Purse.
Yes, which is, I like them a lot.
Well, I'm telling you, if trouble hits, they're on the ground.
They are.
I mean, I get the feeling they show up before the police do. They're on the ground doing good things.
I saw a picture online the other day of Franklin, and I thought he died. I thought he was his daddy.
Yeah, well, yeah. Good point, because he's grown to look like his father
a lot,
and it can't be accidental. The long bushy sideburns and someone like his dad used to have. Franklin, as you may know, was the problem. He was the preacher's kid, the problem child of the Billy Graham family. drugs, alcohol, motorcycles. He was walking on the wild side, probably to get away from being the preacher's kid, which is, I've known many of them over the years, and it's a horrible brand to have put on you because things are expected of you. People don't like you. Da, 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 da. But he has grown into his role and is just a wonderful human. Quick Billy Graham sales story, because I've given not millions or billions, but I've given a lot of money to Billy Graham over the years in its very various incarnations. The first time I was watching Billy Graham on television in a hotel room, and he made the altar call, wherever you are, come, you know, if you're in the third balcony, come on down. It'll take you, I walked it off this afternoon, it'll take you 2 minutes and 30 seconds to be standing. Oh. Come right here. I want you here now. And it looked, they panned to the third deck and it looked like there were electric charges in the chairs as people leapt to their feet doing what they were told. And
so
you
I've
in
never
the
seen
second.
that. Yeah,
Oh,
I've
it's
never
wonderful.
seen anything like that. I'll have to go look for some of these. I'm sure there's YouTube, so I'll have to go look.
Oh, sure. And it's a magnificent sales lesson. I mean, he brings up every possible objection you could have to giving your life to Christ and come to, you know, don't worry, the buses will not leave without you. They will take a head count. The buses will wait. You come down from the second deck. That's a minute and 30 seconds to be standing in front of me. Come on down, and so on. And then, oh, and then that was a night I regave my life to Jesus. I'm thinking, God, I'm glad I'm not in the stadium tonight. He'd have gotten me. And then, you know,
I can see it. It's in my head. I'm sorry. I'm going to be for a while.
I want to repent, but not right now.
And
Right
not in
now.
front of millions of people.
Yeah. And I'm making a lot of money and having a good time traveling around with the power of the microphone. So if you could save me in a year or two, that would be good, but not now. And
oh my goodness.
So I really,
I'm not going to let you live this down. I'm just going to tell you right now. I'm going to return to this over and over again. But keep on.
Well, then he, so I've patted myself on the back for being bright enough to not to get caught in that stadium with him and swept up in the emotion. And he turns to his slave camera, because now they're singing Just As I Am and the crowd's coming forward. He turns to his slave camera and his face fills up the whole screen. And he said, if you can't be with us, I'm paraphrasing, if you can't be with us tonight, if you're at home watching this, if you're in a hotel room. And I thought, oh God, no,
he
no.
can see me. It's romper room all over again.
So he got me. And then later, I don't remember if it was later in that broadcast or the next night, because now I'm watching it every night since I'm a member of the team now. He had Carrie Ten Boom on. She was a survivor of the Auschwitz nightmare and so on. And she wrote a book called The Hiding Place.
She did, and I read it recently.
All right. Well, it's a wonderful book. And what she and her family went through was just horrendous, obviously. And she had been on, and he holds up a copy of The Hiding Place, which I'd intended to buy, whatever hardback book sold for in those days, let's say $14. I don't know what it was. And he said, if you send me your name, Billy Graham, Minneapolis, Minnesota. That was all you had to do to write to Billy Graham. No zip codes, no street address. Billy Graham, Minneapolis, Minnesota. I'll send you a copy of The Hiding Place. And I thought, no, you won't. There's got to be a trick. So, and then later he said, same basic thing about a Bible. And I said, yeah, you won't. So just to test him, I got out some hotel stationery and wrote my name, a mailing address back home, et cetera, sent it to Billy Graham, Minneapolis, Minnesota. And I don't know, a week, 10 days, two weeks later, the books come free, no invoice, nothing. You ask for them, I promise them to you, here they are. So I'm making up numbers. I probably told the story with different numbers, but I sent them, I believe, $1,000 out of guilt because they sent me a $14 copy of The Hiding Place and a free Bible, as promised. And that's always been my guide when I'm given to somebody. If you promise me a free T-shirt if I join the fill-in-the-blank club or support this organization or that, I need another T-shirt, like I need a third foot. However, I'll pay attention as to whether the T-shirt showed up or not. And if it didn't, then I can't trust you with monthly donations or anything else. So write up your own Modesto manifesto as to what you will and won't do, and how you'll conduct yourself, even down to how you're going to dress, how you walk, and everything. Write it up and read it on a regular basis. I won't swear to you that I read mine every day anymore, but I read it frequently, once a week. It's in my tickler file, so I read it at least once a week. And it helps to keep me on track, because in the wonderful world of selling with money flowing around like water, it's
promises. Promises are made, and you're thinking, like you did, yeah, right.
Yeah,
I'm telling you, we wouldn't. You think you remember things? Tick off a woman. We're like elephants.
Yeah, we are going to come.
It might be 10 years down the road, and you're gonna, you know, I never did get that T-shirt. Where is it?
Yep. I hate any sentence that Gigi starts to say that starts out with, as you promised, or as you said. Then, oh, God, whatever it was, I've got to do it now. So I'll just do
it. But I didn't write it down. That doesn't make it so.
So buried in all that, with the free books and The Hiding Place and the Modesto Manifesto and Les Davis and his letters, are great sales lessons. It's up to you to translate them and put them into your lifestyle. It's not important that I hit exactly on what you needed at this moment. When the student is ready, the teacher will appear. And for some of you, the teacher just appeared in the sales and marketing department. Keep your word. Known for keeping your word. Guy called me. I'm probably, you know, we talk so frequently, Denise, I may have shared this with you, but a guy called one time. He said, I was just listening to you on the Bruce Norris radio program. And I'm thinking, God, I know who Bruce Norris is. He's a good friend. Radio program. It was probably 20 years before, but Bruce has saved it and replays it from time to time, puts it out again. He said, will you still honor that special? And I said, I'll be honest with you. I barely remember being on Bruce's show. I don't have any idea what the special is, but lay it on me. If it's at all possible to do, I will. And it was a deal on, you know, get this, and get the free something. And I said, absolutely. He said, the guy said something to the effect of, they told me you'd honor it. They told me you'd honor it. I said, well, the key is, you got to tell me what I'm honoring. Because I truly don't recall. All right, let's get to the book. Go ahead.
We can, and you know, and the reason I wanted to start with this particular page, is it really real? Because everything you've just been talking about is in this particular section. Is it really real? I mean, it's all there, because look, we're all salespeople. All salespeople. And you know my story. I got very offended when I was told I was the best natural salesperson that this guy had ever heard of. And to this day, I know he's long gone. I still think about him and say, I'm sorry. I did not understand what you were saying to me. I'm going to run into him at some point, you know, maybe at the gates. I don't know. And I'm just going to say, I don't know if you remember me, but I think about you all the time. And I do, because he startled me. I mean, my back went up. I went, what? No. Because, you know, excuse
me. Who do you think you're talking to?
Yeah. But that is like, ugh, I'm in here trying to get rid of two little pigs that I bought at an auction because I talk with my hands. I used to talk with my hands. I don't do that anymore. But, and apparently I sold the pigs. because they were in my trunk. Somebody had to get them out of my car. But yeah, bless him. He didn't take the little pigs home, but God bless him. He said, you know, he was telling me that I was persuasive, that I was honest. That's not what I heard. I heard keys jangling, like, take this car, take it for a ride. You're going to love it. No, I won't. So, bless his heart. I think about him all the time.
Well, he gave you an ultimate compliment, and you just weren't tuned in yet as to
I
what you
wasn't.
do.
No.
It's the reason you have a top 2% podcast. People fall in love with you and trust you, and that's the first thing among the first things in selling. I'm trying to get to the book we're writing about. However, I got to share something with you. I was reading an article in, I think, Vanity Fair, believe it or not. I subscribed to it again. They got me again because I keep remembering when all the writers were good and the articles were intriguing and so on. Now it's fluff pieces about people I wouldn't go into a room with and what they're wearing
Or
and,
not wearing.
et cetera. And they hate Trump. I mean, those are the two things. Here's people you don't know, wouldn't spend any time around. That's half the magazine. Another half is almost half is advertising. And P.S. we hate Trump.
No.
So anyway, in the midst of all that, as I'm always saying, I can read a whole book and find one sentence that made it all worthwhile. As you know, I coined the phrase years ago. People like to buy from people they know, like, trust, and years later I added, comma, and with whom they feel safe. And again, in selling, that's one of your goals. So now I'm reading Vanity Fair this month, and they're writing a story about the Danish queen who gave up, who resigned the queenship. I don't think that's royal talk, but whatever. And her son Frederick the 10th has been or is about to become the king. Now he's the crown prince or something. And
I think that already happened. I think he is actually the king now,
well, it may well be his.
according to Twitter.
Yeah, well, there you go.
So we don't really know.
This is April 2024 Vanity Fair. So when he wrote it, it was about to happen. But the Prime Minister Frederiksen complimented the new king or king to be, whatever. Listen to this quote. The crown prince that now becomes our monarch is a king that we know, a king that we like, and a king that we trust. She said, it's a she. They had
He
been,
ripped you off.
but yeah,
Can you
right
sue?
there in Denmark, they're
Oh no.
quoting exactly verbatim. We didn't say king when we first did it,
Right.
but I thought that when I read it, I thought, all right, this magazine that I wish I hadn't subscribed to again. It was worth the $12 or whatever it was for a year, and all the junk I've had to scan through to see that the King of Denmark even falls under the heading of know, like, trust, and with whom we feel safe. Now, page
We have to
244.
talk, and I'm going to interrupt you again. I'm sorry. We have to talk about that no matter where we are, because if we don't, excuse me, if we don't know you, we don't like you, we don't trust you, you're going to get a door slammed in your face, and rightfully so.
Yes. And the good news is, I think we've talked about this recently, but somebody said to me, I've heard said from numerous people, well, yeah, well, that's easy for you to say. You've been in sales for decades and you're known and you don't have to make cold calls because you get referrals and so on. And I said, well, here's some good news for you. I can get someone I've never met before to know, like, trust me, and feel safe with me. The process can start in 10 to 15 seconds. And within 5 minutes, we're lifelong buddies. So the fact I've been in selling for decades and have a reservoir of referrals and reputation and so on is nothing. I can do that cold starting today with no background, no referrals, because I know the importance of doing it. And when we get to it, I am a sales infiltrator, which is on page 257 of the Closers Part 2, and it is wonderful. Now, with your permission.
Okay, fine.
Is it?
Go ahead.
Yeah, give me about 30 seconds before you cut me off again. Is it?
What?
30 seconds? I wasn't asking much.
I'm going to talk to your wife again.
Is it really real? Page 244. And this goes into sort of, in a way, one thing reminds me of another. It might have subconsciously triggered everything else we've talked about so far. Walter Wells was one of the great salesmen. He had his problems. He was an alcoholic. And the way he motivated himself, he'd go out and get a new Lincoln Continental. He loved Lincolns a couple times a year. Which sounds goofy, but he'd lose money on the trade-in, but now he'd be in the hole, and therefore he had to sell. It wasn't that he didn't have the skill to sell, he didn't have the motivation. Anytime I saw Walter Wells in a brand new suit from Muses in Atlanta, which used to be the place to get clothing if you were successful in upper class, I saw him in a new suit. I knew his sales had slumped a little bit, and he got the new suit, so he'd have to make the money to pay Muses for the suit and for the new Lincoln that was parked outside. So he was not without his faults, but he was an older guy to me at the time. Everybody was older, and he knew selling. He was sort of a rough-hewn Jimmy Rucker. Jimmy Rucker could sell you anything and make you feel good about it, and you wouldn't know you were sold. With Walter, you knew he was a salesman. You sort of knew what he was doing, but he was so good, you didn't mind, and you let him do his thing. And the part in here that we're referring to is on the rare occasion when a prospect or a customer client of Walter would resist. And he'd already been through, is it this, is it that, is it this, I write in here, he left no stone unturned, no edge of the carpet unnailed, no door left open when it was time to ask for the order. It was time to ask for the order. He knew it. You knew it. You know, it was just the logical, inevitable conclusion to a sales conversation. But occasionally somebody would say no. And so he would run through the, is it this or that, and so on. And then the killer was, he'd always say, you know, when they'd say, well, it's this. And he would say, smiling kindly and shaking his head gently, he'd lean forward, he'd stare intently into your eyes if you were the prospect. And then very softly, like a kind old grandfather, he'd say, are you really serious or are you just testing my sales ability? And it was a combination of a punch in the mouth, an inside joke between him and the customer, and so on. And they would then come up with a real reason or just laugh and say, you got me. But he had opened up the door where he could say anything to them about anything. People are always saying to me, I can't believe you said that to a customer. I said, I got permission up front. That's in sales infiltration, got permission up front to be straight with them. I said, we call it being straight, straight. I'll be straight with you. You be straight with me, which includes if we get down to the end and what we're having is a case of nerves on your part, not a real objection to the product or service. It's either nerves or a condition. Condition is I didn't qualify you properly and you don't have the money. Jim Rohn used to say to people, it doesn't cost, in that heavy accent of his, it doesn't cost too much. You don't have the money. So that's a condition. But Walter would say, yeah, are you being serious or are you just testing my sales ability? And it was a killer close that would flush out almost any problem or make them get serious at the very end. My favorite close is based on what you've told me, here's what I suggest we do, blah, blah, blah. Fair enough. That flushes out the real objection, or they say fair enough. They never say, no, that's not fair enough. They tell you what they've been holding back that whole time. But to do that, like Walter Wells did in every situation, he got permission first. He was a Southern gentleman. He was older than most of us, had gray at the side, and older than most of his prospects. So when he said to you in a grandfatherly way, you know, you got to be kidding. Tell me the truth is what he was really saying. And so that's that on, is it really real? Is it a real objection? Or have they told you everything? Were you good enough to ferret out everything that could be messing with the sale at that point? And if you've done that, it is time to be straight. Up to and including, it's one of my favorite examples. When said, well, I got to check with my brother-in-law in Cleveland, who's an attorney. I got him up front to agree that they didn't have a brother-in-law in Cleveland. He wasn't an attorney, and they don't have to check with him. I tell him that verbatim up front. When we get to the end and it's time for you to make a decision, yes or no, I can deal with either one. Don't tell me you got to check with this person, check with that person, appeal to a higher authority and so on, because you know it's not true and I know it's not true, right? And that'll go right because there's not an issue on the table now. But 30 minutes later, they'll fall back on it just out of habit. Well, I got to check with my brother-in-law in Cleveland. I said, no. We agreed we wouldn't do that to each other. You know, you're either going to buy or you're not going to buy. I can deal with either one, but if you're not, tell me why. So
I don't understand why people don't understand the word no. You and I have talked about this. Yeah. It's one of my favorite words. I use it a lot. I really do. And as far as I'm concerned, it's a full sentence. If I tell you no, I meant no. I meant it the first time. I meant it the second time. There is no third time. There just isn't. I've already told you no. Now go away. That's it. Go away.
I'll do that from the other side of the table. Is I'm the easiest person to sell if I like your product or know your product. The local home show, which is sort of like the county fair with roofing people instead of rides, was just here in town, and it got rained out both Aww. Days. And I was heartbroken for the promoters because I know they had nobody there, including me. But I was prepared to put on my Bengay the Third Closers shirt, my Bengay the Third Closers hat, and go to it. And I get a lot of attention. Older salespeople, people who know what they're doing, will look up and go, do you work for Bengay or are you Bengay? I said, no, I am. Oh, my God. What an honor to have you here and so on. But what I really like to do after I like the accolades and so on, but besides that, I love hearing a sales presentation. And if it's a bigger ticket item, and I'm a sucker for it, I got more Ginsu knives than Ginsu has. You give a good, or one of those slicer dicer machines, and take all of your fingers off at once if you're not careful. I've got several of those. And Gigi says, one is enough. Why do we have four? I said, because I heard four good sales presentations. Feel free to give them away, but I'm going to buy four more. And the reason I didn't in the last weekend was they got rained out. But I love an effective sales presentation. But if it's a big enough item where we're discussing it in advance, they're about to give their presentation, not the group sale Ginsu knife one, I tell them, I am an easy buyer. I'm qualified to buy, but give it your best shot because I only want to hear it once. And when we're done, I will say yes or no. And it's final. All right. And then you sort of see them, you know, adjust their coat or their jacket, pull themselves together and say, I got one shot at this. Let's make it work. But I'm with you. I'm sort of a quick study. If I say no to you, I mean it. And I told you about the lady who worked either at San Quentin or Lombok when I was teaching classes, either one behind her on the wall, it said, which part of no don't you understand?
Exactly. And I've said that to people many times during my lifetime. And I know I'll say it again. And people may have cause to say it to me, and I'll go, oh, okay, sorry. Because I'll know what I had done, and I'll have to, abase myself a bit and go, oh, I'm so sorry. I wasn't listening, and or whatever it was. But sometimes you need to just be taken down a peg when you're doing what you don't want done to you.
Yeah. But if you do it well, if a sales infiltrator gets you, unless you just don't like the product or don't have the money, those are conditions. If a good sales infiltrator gets a hold of you, you won't have that objection to start with. Repeat, it can be no because you don't want the product or have any need for it. Although I bought many things out of sympathy, lower cost, $20 or less, I'll just hand you 20 and say, keep the knife. That's for giving me the presentation. But on the others, a good sales infiltrator won't run into that. The Kirby vacuum cleaner, I've done work with them off and on over the years. They have a saying, the sale isn't over, the presentation hasn't ended until you have a check, and they mean that, cumulatively, a check, debit card, credit card. So you have a payment in your pocket, or the police have been called.
Ooh.
Until then, you keep, well, they say it sort of jokingly, but they say it. So,
no.
Yeah. So I'm have fought against that good naturedly ever since I started working with them. But the reason I became a sales infiltrator, besides seeing people who actually did it, and I could model it, Jimmy Rucker, Zig Ziglar, and many others, was I'm a Southern gentleman. If you tell me to get out of your house or office, I'm gone. So I designed presentations that don't drive you to ask me to get out of your office or your home. I'm still a welcome.
Go get your secretary, as you used to call her, Marty. You called her your secretary. She was really your boss.
Yes.
So I'm gonna call Marty. Okay, gotta go. Bye.
If Marty is, her real name is Martha Conley, but she was known to everybody as Marty. If Marty is listening, I still admire you. She was, quote, my secretary, but she was really my executive assistant. And
right.
She was really head of the company, because you didn't see me and therefore didn't have a shot at getting a decision on anything unless Marty let you in. So you better be good just to get past Marty. And if she said no, that was the end of the story. And she ran the business, Holiday Magic Cosmetics, and several subsidiaries. Gently, it was after we weren't working together anymore, after I left the company, that it dawned on me I'd been working for her all those years.
How did she, I've never asked you this before, and I can't believe I haven't asked it. How did she and Napoleon Hill get along? I would suspect that they were kind of two sides of the same coin.
Yeah, fine. Dr. Hill could walk past her and just say good morning, not have to ask to go in my office after a while. But in the beginning, he had to deal with Marty. She, of course, probably ordered his plane tickets or sent the Learjet to pick him up or whatever. So it wasn't a surprise when he walked in the office. But in the beginning, she had to deal with him like anybody else. Bill Patrick, the owner of the company, was probably the only person who could just walk past her, and for obvious reasons. It was his building. She was sitting at his desk. He was knocking on his door. It happened to be on my office, but his door, and so on. But even Bill would say, good morning, Marty. How are you? How is it? Is he busy? Whatever. He would go through the motions with her. So she was a formal, but sweet and kind. Everybody loved Marty until perhaps she said no.
Mm.
Do you want to cover one more section or move on?
Yeah.
Or wrap it up?
We've got about 10 minutes, I think. But I wanted you to cover, because at the end of this section, is it really real? You have a warning. So let's share that very quickly, because I think it's important when you're talking about that final close.
Well, that came under the Walter Wells section.
Right.
Fleshing out, is a real objection or not? And then that spills over into the next one, which is Let's Go. And that's Jimmy Rucker, a good friend. He learned under Walter Wells also. We were both just two kids when we joined the organization, and it fell under his spell. And but in Let's Go, Jimmy Rucker was talking to somebody he was training, which started happening rather quickly. And apparently the person said to Jimmy at some point, Jimmy was saying, you're not relating to him, you're not, you know, you're not getting them. And finally he said to Jimmy, oh, you want me to walk a mile in his moccasins? You want to walk a mile in whatever moccasin? So I understand him. He said, no, I want you to take your moccasins off and get 100% centered on the client and what he or she or they think and want to do. And you can't do that while you're you in your moccasins. You got to get in theirs, yes, but first take yours off, which will lead us next time we chat to fourth. It's called Sell from the Audience on page 246. That'll be where we start next time. And the reason that is, it talks about fourth wall perspective. Rucker, in the case of the moccasin story, he's saying you got to get in where they are. They got to feel that you're with them, you're on their team, and that you've taken your moccasins off. You're not the enemy anymore. You're part of their team. And then in the chapter we'll cover next month, fourth wall perspective. Rucker was a master at this, although I don't think either one of us knew the term at the time. I learned it later. When you go to a play, there are four walls. Everybody's aware of three of them. The back wall, which probably has pictures hanging on it because you're in somebody's living room, supposedly. Stage right, which is audience left, but we won't get caught up in all that. To the left, there's a wall. That's where people come in from backstage. To the right, there's a wall. The fourth wall is the audience looking at the scene. And good salespeople use the fourth wall perspective while they're talking, while they're giving their presentation. They're in the play. They are also looking at the play from the fourth wall. They're observing themselves as if they were part of the audience, not the salesperson. And when you can master that little trick, that little psychological manipulation, it gives you a power over the selling situation most people never have.
I can't wait to talk about that one because it is important. And if you don't know that you're doing it, you probably should recognize it or learn how to do it. Basically learn how to do it. One of the things you said, though, you're talking about Jimmy Rucker. You were talking also, it said here, like Billy Graham said at those crusades, whether you understand it or not, I want you to get up out of your chairs and come down here. Take a leap of faith. Do it now. Right. Don't let this moment pass. But above that, in the first paragraph, I love this. I almost marked it in the book, but I didn't. I put a sticky note on it. There, you're talking about, I'm going to convert you into the type of salesperson who sells from the customer side of the table. Jimmy Rucker is talking about that, I guess.
Yep.
One who, and everybody listen carefully. One who understands that selling isn't an armed conflict or a contact sport.
That is absolutely. And the good ones, Jimmy being, he was the best salesperson I ever personally worked with. There are people who sold more, made more, and so on, because, you know, Ross Perot used to make his IBM year-long quota, usually in the first couple of weeks of the year. So neither Jimmy nor I ever made that kind of money and became billionaires. Could have, but didn't. And but as far as in a given sales situation, Rucker was so good. I'd sometimes watch him and forget that I had my own prospects. I'd be staring at Rucker thinking, oh, that's good. I told you that cute story one time. A guy said he forgot his checkbook. This is when people carry checks in their suit pocket vest pocket. And Rucker said, oh, like, you know, that's unbelievable. Stood up, reached across the table, reached into the guy's coat pocket, pulled it. I said, here it is. And that's one of those, if you're not a sales infiltrator, if you haven't become that, see, you could do that to me. We're buddies. I would put up with it. Well, the trick was Rucker became a buddy who could do that in 2 or 3, 4 minutes.
Right. Comfortable. People felt comfortable with him.
Yeah. And you knew with Rucker, you knew you were safe. The fourth addition to know, like, trust. And with whom they feel safe. Rucker would not screw me over.
You know, and as you know, I'm writing The Closers Part 4.
Yes, I'm aware of that.
Because you ordered me to. You said, Denise, you're writing a book. I said, yes. I was the end of that. But one of the things that I'm learning now that I'm really paying attention, I mean, I've read your books. I've talked with you. We've been friends for years. But now that I'm having to write things down, and I'm loving it, by the way, I'm realizing that part of my podcast, my pre-interview, is nothing more or less than a sales process. Yes. Because, I mean, people do come to me. It's a warm call. Their people have sent them. Somebody referred them. I'm not hunting for podcast guests. I don't know that I ever will have to. But they're already coming. They want to come on the show. They've listened. You know, they know who you are. They know who I am. They know who some of the guests are. But once I start talking with them and I'm telling them, particularly if they are authors, as you know, I've got hundreds of books in this room. They get very excited because I'm selling them on what that podcast is going to do for their book sales.
Right.
Whether I mean to or not, I'm so excited that they're going to send me their book. And at the end of it, I had somebody yesterday, in fact, say, Denise, do you need a business partner? No, but thank you. Well, I don't know. Let's talk about it later. But, you know, it's a sales process that I didn't know I was doing. Now, how interesting is that?
Well, that's it goes back to the person who told you that you were a great natural salesperson. You got offended. You're so good. Maybe you're beyond a sales infiltrator. You're an unknown. Remember the conscious incompetent, don't know what they're doing, and they know they don't know what they're doing. The conscious competent, blah blah blah, and the goal supposedly is to become an unconscious competent. I don't think that's true. The goal should be the third level, become a conscious competent, meaning you know what you're doing, you know why you're doing it, you know the effects of it, and so on. Because an unconscious competent is really no better than an unconscious incompetent. So it's a skill that you need to know. And in your case, a skill that you need to acknowledge. You're a great salesperson, offensive as you may find that.
I thought you were going to say offensive as you can be, which is like, come on. I only do that on Wednesdays. But once I started listening to myself, and I always listen to my guests, they're fascinating. And I'll realize that they're getting very excited. I can hear voices go up an octave, and they can see that I'm laying out a vision for them about what can happen with this podcast. They're excited. I'm not selling them a darn thing. There's no money changing hands. But, and I've said this before, many, many, many of my guests become my mentors. I've got their books. I read them. I talk about them. I review them. I get Christmas cards from them. They're my friends. They're my mentors.
Well, and you're very good at it, and that'll be in the book.
It will be, now that I know it has to be.
Yeah. One of the things I've come to understand, and having done, I didn't start counting, it's like speeches. I say over 5,000 paid engagements. It may be 6,000. I don't know, because I wasn't counting in the early days. But that's a pretty good estimate. I've done hundreds of podcasts, and some are really good. They could be recorded and sold as a product, you know, an individual product. And some were not so good. And sometimes that's me, but usually what it is the host. because I can't answer a question you didn't ask. I'm not going to take over your show and just go on and on and on, wondering if that's what you wanted or if that's what your audience wants and so on. So when you get Denise's book, which will be the closers part four, in the subtitle, the word podcasting will appear. I don't think she's decided on that yet, but when you get the book and you want to do your own podcast, A, you're in the hands of a true expert. B, remember, every single show will ride on your interest, your talent, and your ability to make the guests feel comfortable and draw them out with intelligent, meaningful questions. It's on you. But Denise will make it so much easier for it to be on you.
Well, thank you for that. I'm learning just through this process of you ordering me to write a book. That's kind of on the hill, I'm telling you. I'm never going to take that down. But we had the most interesting conversation. It's like, I am writing a book? Really? It was long. It was a fascinating conversation. But once I started going, okay, now I have to put this into words, like real words on paper, it opened up a whole new understanding of how I actually operate.
Yep.
Which is, thank you. I mean, I had no idea. I just get on the phone, I talk, and then I hang up and I go feed the cats. I mean, I've got a process. Apparently, that's not what I'm really doing.
I had that exact experience. I've written, co-written, edited, and or published 35 books, I'm told. The Closers Part 2 was for me, it's one of the reasons I love to teach from it, was for me that type of experience. I stopped, put everything aside, and wrote down what I had learned and experienced and seen, good and bad. And I remember I couldn't wait to write it, unlike some books I've written. I couldn't wait to get to the writing every day because I was going to learn something new because it forced me to think.
It does. And one of the chapters that I was writing part of the time yesterday, yes, as you know, yesterday was rough, but part of it was, how did this all begin? And I tell that story because people say, well, you know, why did you start podcasting? Oh, there's so many reasons, but none of them really make sense unless you get to the beginning of it. So once I got that idea in my head, I went, oh, I could see the whole chapter in my head.
Well, you're going to bring a lot of value to a lot of people.
That's the plan. I sure hope I can. Listen, we are out of time, and thank you so much for joining with me and letting me pick on you. I appreciate that. I know Gigi says, be nice to her. Don't make her mad. So, she's not a nice person. I'm so glad you're here every Wednesday. So tell people where they can find you, find your mentoring program, and of course, the sales Bibles, the closers.
On the mentoring program, I don't have any openings right now, but if you want to get in the line and first come, first serve, in other words, we'll do it in the order people put in applications, just send me an email at bfg3, that's the number 3, B as in Ben, F as in Frank, G as in Gay, the number 3, at DirectCon, DirectCon.net. Get the word mentoring in the subtitle and since in the subject line. And since I just told you we don't have any openings, don't be offended when you're not immediately accepted. I want to work with 30, 35 people at a time because I want to give everybody the individual attention they deserve. And but people retire, people die, people move on. I don't get along with some people. I know you find that hard to believe.
No,
so there
I,
will
no,
be
I,
open.
I can't believe that. None. No.
Then if you want to get the material from which we teach the Closers series, the best place to get it, special pricing, free shipping, I still sign them and date them. Go to stores, stores.ebay.com/ all one word, Ronzoni Books, RONZONEBOOKS. Order by 2 o'clock any day. It goes out that day. We call it sudden shipping. And that's it.
Perfect. And I'm going to go ahead and put myself on the line here. I've already decided, because I'm doing a fair number of mentoring people who want to become podcasters on either side of the microphone, mostly both. And they're coming out and saying, Denise, can you teach me what you know? So, oh, I could sure try. You know, I can give you the nuts and bolts of it. And being a techie nerd in stilettos, I can tell you how to do this, 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 and don't do that. But I have decided, because I really want people to understand how you and I do the things that we do, when my book comes out, and it's not going to be too much longer now, anybody who is mentoring with me for podcasting, even if they've already done, their podcast is already out there, they're going to get a copy of the book.
Oh, excellent.
And I don't know what the shipping's going to cost, so don't ask. I only want 3 people to apply.
The first 2 people.
Yeah. No, anybody who works with me on podcasting is going to get a copy of The Closers Part 4. So listen, Ben, thank you so much. And I'll tell you where to find me. I am easy to find online. And you're welcome to contact me directly toll free at 888-719-6711. It does not ring in my home, and that's deliberate. My office is in my home. Leave a message and I will return your call. Just